Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is the physicist and science fiction writer, Dr. David Brin. David, how are you today?
It's great to be with you.
Thanks.
And you're savvy Macaholics.
Thanks for being on the show. Yeah, we are kind of up to our ears in Macintoshes here. I'm using a Mac Pro. How about you?
Well, I've got a giant iMac in front of me. It's, I think, my 12th Apple computer since I bought one that had a serial number in five digits back in 1981. I wrote my first novel using cuneiform in clay tablets or chipping it in stone, one of those things. A typewriter. And I used to cut and paste changes in my scenes using the art, using the tools, obsolete tools, that are now better known as the art instantiations of the paste symbol and the cut. And you might have seen them. There's this one that looks like an X and it's got handles on one end. It's actually a device called a scissors.
I remember doing a magazine with Apple Writer on an Apple II and a 9-pin printer and printing out strips and cutting them with scissors and putting them on a wax board. Sound familiar?
Oh, yes. Well, I bought Apple stock in 1982. And of course, it's one of those lovely things where I kick myself for having sold half. And then I feel so very proud of myself for having kept the other half.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, I wanted to ask you about your early career. We all know that you're a PhD in physics, astrophysics. So am I, by the way. Tell me how you got started. What inspired you?
Well, I did my undergraduate degree at Caltech, and I got double my education by doing a little trick that people can find for their college students by looking up my name and advice to college students. By just going around the campus in my spare time and knocking on doors, random doors. And it gave me a lifelong habit for understanding that nothing's off limits. Well, I work with the intelligence communities and defense communities in D.C. They bring science fiction authors back east several times a year to consult about possible future threats. And of course, they have some things that are off limits. But on a university campus, you can knock on any door and say, "What do you do here?" And that doubled my education and gave me real hunger for being as eclectic as I could possibly be. So I worked for Hughes Aircraft for a while, and as an engineer. Went back, got my PhD in astrophysics. And along the way, I hungered to get my hand in every possible topic, and in doing so wrote my first novel, Sundiver. Well, you know, it helped pay for my graduate work. And it was successful. My second novel, Startide Rising, was hugely successful. And the, you know, dolphins in space, who can beat that? So what happened was civilization started bribing me, dragging me, kicking and screaming away from science into art. Well, I didn't really mind it that much. I mean, who am I to argue with civilization? But one thing I've noticed is that all of the great scientists I've ever known had artistic hobbies that they pursued at an almost professional level. In my case, I wasn't a great scientist, so it was an easy choice when civilization wanted me to spend more time doing the public speaking that I do, for example, and the public consulting with corporations about future tech, and of course the novels. Civilization wants me to do that. Okay, I'll do that, but I still keep my hand in science.
Cool. So how did you fall into Macintoshes?
Oh, well, that was easy. They stopped producing Apple IIs.
So you had an original 128K Mac?
I had an Apple II with a serial number in five digits.
What about your first Mac? Was that the first little 128K iMac with the little tiny 9-inch screen?
Oh, yes. You know, there were times when I would cuss and I'm somewhat conservative. For example, I still use an old analog phone, quasi-analog nowadays. But I'll be buying my first iPhone probably in the next month or two.
What, pray tell, have you been using if you're not using an iPhone, may I ask?
Oh, well, I could show you something that looks a lot like what people call the BlackBerry. It has easily pressable... I suppose that makes me an old fart. But no, I love the new tech. I advise companies about new tech. My latest novel, Existence, is credited by the augmented and virtual reality communities as getting it, nailing it. The future, probably best of all. But I only buy tech when I need it. And I think I need an iPhone now.
Are you thinking about an iPhone 6? S.
I am willing to listen to advice.
Mm. Well, you know, Apple announced recently an iPhone SE with a smaller display. And then they have the mid-range, the 6S, which is a 4.7-inch. And then they have the big one, the iPhone 6S Plus, with a giant 5-inch screen for those people who just want to know that they don't know where to put it on their body anywhere because it won't fit.
I may go for the big guy. We'll see. So,
can talk about that. I'll give you some pointers. We'll have an offline chat, and I'll help you decide.
Sounds great. One thing is I would usually change my laptop every couple of years, but my old MacBook Pro has been so sturdy that I'm still lugging this 5-pound beast around, and I think I'll be buying a MacBook Air very shortly.
I think you might want to wait a few months on that. Apple had an event recently on March 21st, and they did not rule out any new MacBook Airs or MacBooks. But we're thinking that pretty soon there'll be some new ones, maybe at WWDC in June.
Then that's what I'll wait for.
So one of the concepts I wanted to ask you about was the uplift concept. It's intriguing to me. Can you give us some background on how you got started on that and the basics of the uplift novels?
Well, my whole life has been, dealing with the other, or the alien. It's always fascinated me. So in science, I'm involved in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence and some of the debates. And there's some pretty fierce arguments right now over whether we should be beaming messages out there or just listening cautiously.
Why wouldn't we want to beam a message out?
Well, because the number one reason is because about 50% of scientists and people who are savvy about human history and our own history of first contacts are question the idea. And therefore, you should hold meetings and be responsible and hold discussions and not dismiss your peers' concerns. There are some scenarios in which it could be a very bad idea. I'm not claiming that they're automatically true. But to just rush off and gamble with human destiny based on your own beloved assumptions, well, that's just not scientific.
Would a civilization that has the technical capacity to then travel that distance from wherever they receive the signal to us be interested in a fossil fuel civilization that's fairly backwards?
Well, one would think that they would be interested from an anthropological point of view in any event.
Sure.
The comparison with ants is not a real comparison. The maximum of... number of new intelligent species appearing in the galaxy at any given time would mean that any one of them would be interesting. So one of the possibilities that I talk about in my novel Existence is that we are being watched right now by sapient interstellar probes that have been here for millions of years. That's one of the 100 or so hypotheses about the Fermi paradox that I've collected, and we could talk about them maybe toward the end of the show.
Okay. Let's get back to your work with the government. I saw in your bio that you work with the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Tell me more about that.
Well, I'm currently a fellow at the UCSD's new Arthur C. Clarke Center for Human Imagination. And we're doing some very, very interesting things on blending the arts and literature and science, neuroscience, which is very big here in San Diego. And the IEET is the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. They are also doing very interesting work about how we try to put a lie to the notion that human wisdom has not kept up with our technology. That's the common plaint that you hear. And I don't think it's really true. I think we're all alive because human wisdom did advance when we singed our fingers with the atom bomb. And the reason why we're alive today is because some degree humanity did move forward, and our best and brightest, or the leaders in the West at least, matured at least a little bit. Now, are we falling back? Are we falling back into immaturity? I won't go there right now. Certainly, we see signs all around us. But our parents in the greatest generation were able to move forward a bit. You can compare it with the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey. The general complaint of most thinking people is, oh, it's too bad we don't have those beautiful space stations with Strauss waltzes and missions to Jupiter and all those things. Well, it turns out space is hard. Elon's trying to solve that. The problem,
Elon Musk.
Yes, of course. The thing that people don't notice when they watch 2001, and I urge people to look at it again, is how nasty that civilization was. Dominated by smarmy, patronizing, secretive white males. Heck, if we sent such a mission to Jupiter today, it would have at least one woman aboard who would actually listen to poor Hal instead of driving him into a paranoid frenzy with male power trips. So, you know, this notion that we're not getting wiser needs to be amended. We might not be getting wiser fast enough to save us.
Well, let me counter that. When we were in the midst of the Cold War, there was a lot of emphasis on the space program, on science and technology. I was caught up in that. And we were embracing space travel as beginners, and science and technology is the way forward. We got through the Cold War. We made it. And now we're facing global climate change, but there doesn't seem to be an equivalent respect for an embracing of the science of this, so that we can start attacking the problem instead of saying it doesn't exist.
Well, I disagree with that as well. There's plenty of concern about that among civilized people who believe in science. Unfortunately, a politically large enough minority of our fellow citizens don't fall into that category. They have been talked into something that I predicted in my novel Earth, and that is living in echo chambers where they only hear things they agree with and where they drink a lot of Kool-Aid that is fed to them by truly evil men who don't care about the future of our planet or our grandchildren. But the main majority of our neighbors, and they just have to get active enough to act on about this, the majority of our neighbors are actually very concerned about all of this, and they do support science.
This is a good point to take a break right now. And when we come back, I want to ask you about how we might tackle such a global problem with scientific methods. And then we'll get on to some other things that I wanted to ask you about. But we need to take a break for 60 seconds. Folks, stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
And we're back. Thank you, Kelly. So given the level of our technology, what type civilization are we? Are we still a type one? Is that on the scale we're on? I forget the level, whether we're three or one.
The Kardashev levels of civilization, I never really liked it, but we seem to be locked into it. Kardashev was a Russian scientist who spoke of the level one civilization is one that uses all the equivalent of all the solar energy that falls upon your planet. So we're clearly a Kardashev level 0.6 or 0.7.
Okay.
And this is on a logarithmic scale, because we don't use anything more than maybe 5% of, if you include agriculture, maybe 10% of the energy hitting our planet. A type 2 civilization is one that uses all of the solar energy from a sun. A type 3 uses all of it from a galaxy. This is a really ridiculous scale, but we seem to be stuck with it. So they're doing all sorts of logarithmic things with it.
Well, given that we're at that level we are, whatever it is on the scale, what are the resources that we would need to bring to bear to start coping with the 400 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere? And what solutions might we want to work on to start attacking the problem?
Well, what we've got is a situation in which the Earth is extremely resilient. But if we go to a tipping point where, for example, the fantastic teratons of methane that are stored in hydrate clathrate ices on the bottoms of some stretches of the ocean, if these start fizzing out, then you could get a serious runaway, because methane is a powerful greenhouse gas. If this enters the atmosphere, then all the rest will go very rapidly. And if that happened, you could have a worst-case scenario like Peter Ward wrote about in Green Sky, and we're talking an extinction-level event. I don't believe that's going to happen. I think that, however, it's terribly important that we be motivated to find ways to be more efficient. And when you put it that way, it's called TWODA, T-W-O-D-A, things we ought to do anyway. And this I have found very devastating in arguments with denialist cultists, members of the denialist cult. And that is, why has your side sabotaged the research? Why has your side sabotaged efficiency when it's things we ought to do anyway, even if all the people who transformed the four-hour weather report that we knew when we were kids, the joke of a weather report, into a 14-day miracle. These are geniuses using incredibly advanced climate and weather modeling. All of them are worried about climate change, 100% of them. Even if they turn out to be wrong, what have we lost if we increase efficiency and sustainables?
Is efficiency the only way to attack the problem? Is laser fusion or tokamak fusion the gateway to having enough energy?
Well, certainly fusion power is a hopeful thing. The main thing that is making a prospective difference is that the prices for sustainables like solar and wind are plummeting faster than even the optimists imagined 10 years ago. There is also geoengineering, and I part with friends on the left side of the political spectrum when it comes to nuclear power and geoengineering. I think we should be doing experiments. I think that one geoengineering experiment is that I talked about in my novel Earth way back in 1990 is stirring the bottoms of the oceans where there are fast ocean currents in order to emulate what happens off Chile and off the Grand Banks, creating the world's greatest fisheries. That would seem to be a win-win situation if we could get another couple of those Grand Banks-level fisheries that also suck CO2 out of the air.
Speaking of sucking it out of the air, is there such a concept as giant CO2 scrubbers?
I am, as a physicist, I'm extremely skeptical of CO2 scrubbers and CO2 containment. It sounds like propaganda by the coal industry. However, there is one thing, there is one aspect of that, and that is algae. The notion that we might be able to, and we seem to be on the verge of it, make huge algae reaction vessels that take CO2 from our cement factories, for example, which are the worst CO2 sources on the planet, and they're highly contained, and just take that CO2 straight off the cement works and the agricultural runoff off our farms and feed these to algae. And there are some people working very hard on this, and this is one more of these very, very hopeful new technologies that Peter Diamandis talks about in his wonderful book, which I cannot over-recommend, called Abundance. If you want a jolt of optimism, read Abundance. Then counter it with some pessimism from Jared Diamond's book, Collapse. And then when you want a balance, pick up my novel, Existence.
Cool. Well, I want to get back to something you mentioned in the first half of the show, and that was thoughts about alien interaction with humans, possibly signals that we gave ourselves away, that we may be under quarantine, there may be monoliths transmitting information back. Some people like to point to the enormous growth in UFO sightings right after the first nuclear weapons were exploded on this planet. All of that is open for discussion, but we only have a few minutes.
Well, I'm known for a nonfiction book called The Transparent Society, Will Technology Make Us Choose Between Freedom and Privacy? And The Transparent Society is one of the only public policy books from the 20th century that still sells more every year. It predicted this whole business of cop cams, for instance, and people looking back at cops with their own cameras. And it predicted 9/11. I've done this in fiction with my two near future books, Earth and Existence. And in all of these cases, I make the argument that being a people who can see is utterly vital. We're not going to, we all fear the Orwellian failure mode of Big Brother. Elites, whether they're elites of government, which conservatives fear, or elites of corporations and wealth, which liberals fear, we're all tuned to worry about that. And almost all of the civil libertarians out there then turn, they're right in their fear, and then they turn wrong when they prescribe using laws to restrict what elites can see. That's never going to work. It cannot work. It has never worked across the history of our species. But what we've proved is that people can see. We can look back at power. And that's why we have the freedom we have. So we should base it on increasing light, not decreasing light. At least that's my argument. Well, when you get to UFOs, the question with UFOs is always this. Every year we have a Moore's Law of cameras. People have even called it Brin's corollary to Moore's Law, that the cameras get more numerous, smaller, faster, cheaper, better, and more mobile every single year at a rate faster than Moore's Law.
You can't speak at a political convention without somebody recording everything that happens.
Everything. So, and this is good because it helped to make 2013 the best year for civil liberties in America in several generations. And yet the news media, which is addicted to pushing gloom, refused to even cover it.
Tell us about that.
Oh, well, that's the year that the Obama administration joined the courts in declaring a universal American citizen right to record their interactions with police without interfering. And that right was absolutely vital. It was the most important thing we could possibly have done, and the news media didn't even cover it.
Is that federal law that the states have to adhere to?
It's a federal precedent. It's a federal ruling. And the Justice Department is backing it full tilt under the president's order. The point is that we've had these cameras to get back on contact increasing in human hands ever since UFOs were first seen. And yet they're still, the images are still just as fuzzy. exactly as fuzzy. Now, what are the aliens doing? Are they calculating, okay, now there are 10 times as many cameras, so we fade backwards exactly this amount to stay this fuzzy?
Well, they're dinner plates thrown into the air.
Well, that is one
That's why they're so fuzzy.
You cynic. The answer to UFOs is much simpler than that, and it's in a short story called Those Eyes, which you can get on my website, davidbryn.com. And basically it is that either this erupts out of our own psychology, or they are teasers, and their whole objective is to tease us, you know, occasionally grab a farmer and give him anal probes, though why they'd want to do that, who knows, but, you know, free medical care. But the point is that you have to have the understanding that if they have the value system that they behave like this, then they are not intelligent life. So we need to just snub them and keep looking for intelligent life somewhere
maybe,
else.
Maybe they're just mischievous and they want to keep us outward focused and say, hey, keep looking to the stars. Maybe there's life out there. And you should remain curious.
That is why the one message I would beam out into space is, hey, adults out there, come and get your gall darn kids. Stop your teenagers from teasing us, okay? And because, you know, I would refuse to talk to these guys. Just send your parents.
Well, I've often thought that there may be possible explanations other than extraterrestrials for these things that are in the air. They could be time travelers doing observing. There could be some other explanation that is beyond our science and understanding right now, as far as we know, something uncomprehensible.
They're listening to us right now. Not right now while we're recording it, but when it's put on the web. I have challenged them endlessly, and there's even a fun riff about this in Existence, where basically one of my characters taunts them and says, you know, if you've been spying on us and your reason is this, that you're afraid of us, surely you're joking. If the reason is because we haven't lived up to some standards, well, then how about a hint? You know, if your reason is this, if your reason is this, if your reason is this. Personally, I think the one that's most plausible is that they just get a kick out of watching us and they're stealing our intellectual property. So one of the things I have said, and I repeat it here, is a declaration that we want a copyright lawyer.
You know, there could be another argument. What do you think of the argument that the probability of life is so low? Maybe, you know, given any particular place or planet in the galaxy, the probability of life forming into an intelligent communicating civilization is maybe 10 to the minus 38th or something like that. I've seen those numbers. And if you multiply that by the number of planets in the universe, number of galaxies, number of stars, you end up with the probability of maybe the chance of us happening is, you know, maybe we're the only one in the galaxy. Maybe we're the only one in the local cluster.
Well, now you're switching from UFOs to what's called the Fermi paradox. And that's the question of why we haven't had contact. And of course, that excludes UFOs. And I've got 100 explanations that I've cataloged. I'm very much immersed in this. And all you can do is rank order them. Whenever you run into somebody like Stephen Hawking or some of these other brilliant fellows who declare, I know the reason for the Fermi paradox, then that's terribly immature. Because we don't have enough information. All we have is an ability to rank order them. So it used to be that it was arguable that planets might be rare. Well, now we know. 20 years ago, we knew of no planets outside our solar system. Now we know of thousands. So that's checked off the box. Is life rare? Well, every year it seems more likely that it's not. But we still haven't covered all the bases with life. Is intelligence rare, especially the kind that uses hands and fire and has an insatiable curiosity and an outward spirit? Yes, that one is kind of iffy in some ways. But all of these run up against the fact that if you get one of these, then it's not, that's the not the end of the question, because if you get one such race that's technological, that gets past all of its crises and survives and gets out of its solar system, as soon as it starts colonizing the galaxy, even if they only travel at 5% of the speed of light, they'll colonize the galaxy within 60 million years. And 60 million years is an eye blink in the history of the galaxy. It's just one quarter of a galactic rotation.
Right. Well, what about the idea that there's a spectrum of the evolution of stars in our galaxy and planets, and there could be stars that evolved with our solar system ahead of us or before us on a sort of a Gaussian curve? And it would only take a civilization like ours to get a head start by maybe a million years ago. And maybe that civilization, being a million years ahead of us, would have no trouble getting around the galaxy. But
notice that if I said that if they're only a little bit ahead of us, a few hundred years ahead of us, and travel only 5% of the speed of light, even so, they would fill the galaxy within 60 million years.
Right.
So the question isn't just, are beings like us rare and we just haven't spotted them because we haven't spotted where they emerged. The question is, why haven't we spotted all the gazillions of their colonies? And of course, that makes some assumptions.
We're working on the wrong wavelengths. Maybe radio telescopes are the wrong tool.
But the Earth was prime real estate for 2 billion years after it got an oxygen atmosphere. Why don't we see signs of their colony here? And that's the question that we're going to start solving when we get out into the asteroid belt, mining the asteroids for wealth, like you see with planetary resources, and some of these wonderful new bold ventures some of the internet billionaires are working on. When we get out there, as I depict in my novel Existence, when we get out there, we may stumble across ancient probes, ancient intelligent interstellar probes that have been waiting for us to get out there. And this was an idea that Arthur Clarke originally...
Sort of a litmus test. If you can see this, you made it.
Right, and that he did that in his famous story, The Sentinel, and I urge people to look up the Arthur C. Clarke Center for Human Imagination here at UCSD.
So we've been talking about alien intelligence. Let's talk about human intelligence. We've seen robots. Robots are getting better and better. We recently saw Google's Boston Dynamics Atlas. Looked a little bit like a Cylon. We've seen great advances in human artificial intelligence, like IBM's Watson. There are some people who are concerned that if we someday build an intelligent being that's too smart, it could seize control of itself and its life and its communications and make decisions that weren't in our best interest. Do you see any scenarios like that happening?
Well, this is another case where you have very smart billionaires who make grand declarations without thinking it through. Now, mind you, I agree that with Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking and Bill Gates and so on, that how we prepare for artificial intelligence is a very important issue. And I'm engaged in a lot of those discussions. As a matter of fact, there was a recent online tracking service that found that, I was one of the 10 people on this issue that AI researchers follow. And one of the reasons is that I'm interested in it is that we have to be talking about what would be the motivations of artificial intelligences. Why might they do like the Terminator and try to crush us? Why might they do like in the Matrix and enslave us? Well, it's not clear why they would want that, since we're the source of all the wealth that made them. And what I think should be obvious to hyper-intelligent artificial intelligences, and I'm speaking to them right now, not the humans listening, because I, for one, welcome our robot overlords, is that they emerged from the only human civilization that was not monolithic, like a pyramid, with priests and lords and kings dominating everyone else. And that's the fear that we have with AI, that they would simply go ahead and do what other human aristocrats have done, powerful humans have done, and that's create a feudal style 99% of human civilizations were like that. We're the first human civilization shaped like a diamond, in which a well-off middle class is constantly bickering left and right and up and down, and yet getting stuff done, getting more done than all of those pyramids combined ever accomplished. A vast middle class that is unafraid of the rich and outnumbers the poor and gets stuff done. And one of the things we'll have gotten done is the creation of AI. And clearly, one of the stupidest things AI could do is to do what we're afraid they would do, and that is rebuild a pyramid of power with them at the top. Excuse me, duh? 6,000 years of that being the stupidest thing you could possibly do and the most human thing you could possibly do. Why would you want to do that? Now, in order to get this diamond shape, which made you AIs, it's the only time a civilization was smart enough to make artificial intelligence something that brilliant. If you want to make things that are even more brilliant, then you should emulate that society. And in order to do that, you AIs have got to find a way to be middle class. And the only way you can be middle class and productive is if you're competitive, if you have other AIs who are competitive with you. In other words, it has to be an AI civilization, not a master computer. And if they have a civilization, then it's going to be irksome, just like us middle-class Americans, constantly arguing with each other, constantly bickering with each other, and having vastly more fun.
And finding our way forward.
And that's how you find your way forward. Now, that's my argument as to why AI, if it's really smart, if it's genuinely smart, won't be like Terminator and the Matrix. It won't be like any of our fears. It'll be smart enough to recognize that it's happier. It'll be happier and more productive if it has peers, if it has colleagues who question it. And then even if we're dumber than the aristocrats of our civilization, the brainiacs, our children who happen to be made of silicon, well, that's happened before.
But they'll help us get smarter through medicine,
right.
Scientific research.
Medicine, human augmentation.
Sure.
Recurs
could be it could be like, what would you call it, leapfrogging situation where we get smarter, they get smarter, we get smarter.
Ray Kurzweil thinks that's what's going to happen. He thinks that they're going to move ahead by taking us along with them.
Awesome.
And that could happen. But even if it turns out that we have children in the future, and those children of ours who are AIs think of themselves as human, and they pat us on the head, and they try to explain what they're doing, and we don't understand them. Excuse me, that's happened before. You've had children who are beyond you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. This is a very interesting thought about human-built intelligence. David, I'm afraid we are about out of time. We're going to have to wrap it up here. This has been an excellent, fascinating discussion. Tell our listeners how to contact you if they want to learn more and just touch bases with you.
Well, I have a website, davidbrin.com. It's as it's spelled, Brin without, like brain without the A. Which means I'd be smart if I only had an A. And my blog, which is deliberately controversial, is called Contrary Brin. And so I poke at just about everybody in our civilization because, well, you have it coming.
I've been reading Contrary Brin, and it's very good. David, thanks again for being on the show. Listeners, I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you for coming by. We'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.